Following are comments on William Shakespeare's The Two Noble Kinsmen, Act 5. O sacred, shadowy, cold, and constant queen! As the deadly competition nears, Arcite and his comrades pray to the god of war, Mars, to grant them victory in the contest, while Palamon and his comrades pray to the goddess of love, Venus, to grant him Emilia's love. Emilia herself, along with her female attendants, prays that she may remain a chaste votary of the goddess Diana. In Act 5, Scene 1, Theseus suggests that Palamon and Arcite should spend due time on religious ritual to sanctify their bloody course. He says, quote unquote, "Lay by your anger for an hour, and dove-like, before the holy altars of your helpers, the all-feared gods, bow down your stubborn bodies." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 11 through 13. "Let them not, as some ancient heroes did and paid the price, disrespect or disregard the gods and put themselves first." Both Palamon and Arcite follow Theseus's strong advice, with Arcite praying to the god of war, Mars, for victory in the contest, and Palamon praying to the goddess of love, Venus, for Emilia's affections. Arcite says to his men, quote unquote, "You know my prize must be dragged out of blood. Force and great feet must put my garland on, where she sticks, the queen of flowers." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 42 through 45. The Norton editor's note says that Emilia herself is, quote unquote, "the queen of flowers." The embeddedness of blood and violence with floral imagery in this utterance reminds us of the closeness of love and death throughout this play. Palamon's prayers to Venus are also appropriate. Quote unquote, "Our argument is love, which, if the goddess of it grant, she gives victory to." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 70 through 72. He goes on to suggest, by implication, that his favored deity, Venus, spreads her power of desire over all human affairs and activities, while Mars's influence is logically more restricted to the battlefield. Quote unquote, "What godlike power hast thou not power upon?" Palamon asks Venus rhetorically. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 89 through 90. Both Palamon and Arcite receive signs from heaven that seem to favor their respective causes, and then it's Emilia's turn to pray. She invokes the goddess Diana, Artemis for the Greeks, goddess of the hunt, protector of childbirth, and defender of chastity, among other things. Emilia begins with the beautiful invocation, quote unquote, "O sacred, shadowy, cold, and constant queen, abandoner of revels, mute, contemplative." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 137 through 138. She goes on to pray that the goddess may grant victory to the contestant who truly loves her best, or else grant that, quote unquote, "the file and quality I hold I may continue in thy band." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 161 through 162. Emilia's goddess answers her with a single rose, which the Norton editor glosses as a, quote-unquote, "symbol of virginity, blooming on the rose tree that has just sprouted near the altar. But the rose falls and down comes the rose tree." It seems, then, that Emilia's last-mentioned prayer will not be granted. She will become a wife. She herself appears to remain somewhat uncertain about the goddess's intentions. Quote-unquote, "I shall be gathered, I think so, but I know not thine own will. Unclasp thy mystery." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 170 through 172. "I'll warrant you, within these 3 or 4 days, I'll make her right again." The doctor is pleased with the improvement in the condition of the jailer's daughter. He encourages the wooer to continue playing Palamon, and even suggests that the wooer should sleep with her in that guise. In Act 5, Scene 2, The root of the jailer's daughter's madness, or love melancholy, seems to lie in a very strong feeling of possessiveness combined with sexual frustration. The doctor's remedy appears to be working to lessen the sting of possessiveness, since, after all, she now more or less believes that Palamon is visiting her to her heart's content. The wooer informs the doctor that he has already kissed the daughter twice, and the doctor tells him to, quote-unquote, fit her home and presently. Act 5, Scene 2, Line 11. As Norton footnote 1 on page 525 suggests, this means a little more, actually a lot more, than kiss. The doctor apparently wants the wooer to go ahead and bed the daughter, and he makes this even plainer when he says, quote-unquote, lie with her if she asks you. Act 5, Scene 2, Line 18. No chivalric reticence is deemed necessary in the treatment of this lower-class girl of, according to her father, 18 years of age. The remedy should be pursued without shame. The jailer objects, but the doctor overrules him. The rest of the scene suggests that the jailer's daughter is still not in her right mind, and it's all that her father, the wooer, and the doctor can do to keep up with her mostly happy delusions about her relationship with Palamon. Quote unquote, we shall have many children, she says at one point. Act 5, Scene 2, Line 93. Still, the doctor is encouraged and says, quote unquote, I'll warrant you, within these 3 or 4 days, I'll make her right again. Act 5, Scene 2, Lines 103 through 104. If that's what the learned doctor says, who are we, the audience, to disagree? O all you heavenly powers, where is your mercy? Emilia can't bring herself to watch the tournament. At first, shouts indicate that Palamon has won, but then are heard cries of Arcite, and since the latter has in fact emerged victorious, Palamon and his comrades are liable to immediate execution. In Act 5, Scene 3, Emilia has no stomach for the death match that is only moments away, so she remains at some distance from the tournament field, where she can only hear what transpires, not see it. When she proves herself unmovable in this decision, the others look to the tournament. All sorts of worries beset Emilia, and after much of the usual praise aimed at the less outwardly impressive Palamon, she exclaims to herself, quote unquote, oh, better never born than minister to such harm. Act 5, Scene 3, Lines 65 through 66. When the initially inaccurate cry of Palamon rings out, Emilia alone makes a revealing remark. Quote unquote, poor servant, meaning Arcite, thou hast lost. Upon my right side still I wore thy picture, Palamon's on the left. Why so? I know not. I had no end in it, else chance would have it so. On the sinister side the heart lies. Act 5, Scene 3, Lines 72 through 76. As she goes on to explain, Palamon therefore, quote unquote, had the best boding chance to win since the contest is about an affair of the heart. Act 5, Scene 3, Line 77. It really sounds as if she favors Palamon, but isn't sure as to the reason for that election. Arcite finally wins the contest, forcing Palamon to touch the pyramid with his body. He says gracefully to Emilia, quote unquote, to buy you, I have lost what's dearest to me, save what is bought, and yet I purchased cheaply as I do rate your value. Act 5, Scene 3, Lines 112 through 114. The Duke joins their hands together, but Emilia is apparently too distraught to speak any words at all, much less decorous ones. Theseus satisfies any qualms he may have with a speech praising Palamon and an affirmation that the battle was so evenly fought as to preclude easy judgments. As Theseus and the company prepare to depart, Emilia finally speaks, quote unquote, is this winning? O all you heavenly powers, where is your mercy? Act 5, Scene 3, Lines 138 through 139. The whole experience leaves her, she says, with little purpose in going on aside from the divinely ordained one of bringing, quote-unquote, comfort to a man who has, in her view, sacrificed a companion worth more, in truth, than she will ever be. Hippolyta shrewdly observes, quote-unquote, infinite pity that four such eyes should be so fixed on one that two must needs be blind for it. Act 5, Scene 3, lines 144 through 146. Theseus adds his approval to this observation, but it really seems to be the women who most acutely understand and feel the truth of what has happened. It has all been fueled, as Hippolytus' figure implies, by a fierce triangulation of erotic desire, two men wanting one woman till death decide the victor. The conquered triumphs, the victor has the loss. As Palamon awaits execution, the news comes that Arcite's horse has crushed him almost to death. Dying, Arcite admits his fault in pursuing Amelia, even though Palamon saw and claimed her first. With his final words, Arcite cedes his interest in Amelia to Palamon. At court, Palamon finds out from the jailer that his daughter is doing well and is now married. Theseus decrees a period of mourning, after which all will celebrate the wedding of Palamon and Amelia. In Act 5, Scene 4, Palamon speaks with grace as he awaits the executioner's axe, but it's perhaps his second knight who offers the best conventional gloss on what is about to happen. Quote unquote, "O'er us the victors have fortune, whose title is as momentary as to us, death is certain. A grain of honor they not o'erweigh us." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 16 through 19. To men who have always lived by the chivalric honor code, this is no doubt a compelling argument. Everyone knows Lady Fortune is fickle, and the medieval Wheel of Fortune was regularly invoked to deal with the blows that life delivers, or as Hamlet calls them, quote-unquote, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. That's from Act 3, Scene 1 of Hamlet. We can thank Palamon for helping us to learn how things are going with the jailer's daughter. He asks the jailer about her and is informed that, quote-unquote, she's well restored and to be married shortly. Act 5, Scene 4, lines 27 through 28. For once, some unalloyed good news in this play. But as for Palamon's supposedly sad fate, that isn't to be. Just as he's about to be beheaded, news comes that Arcite, while riding a black steed that Emily had gifted to him, has been crushed by the horse as it reared over difficult ground and fell. It's interesting to note that Arcite, whom Emilia always credited for his quote-unquote fairness, a complex quality that Palamon, she has told us repeatedly, partly lacks, is done to death, literally, by a dark horse. Arcite's last speech is mostly spent on bequeathing Emilia to his best friend, Palamon. Quote unquote, "Take Emilia, and with her all the world's joy. Reach thy hand. Farewell. I have told my last hour. I was false, yet never treacherous. Forgive me, cousin." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 90 through 93. Thus, and with a kiss for Emilia, dies the noble Arcite. He cedes ground forever to Palamon's claim a while back that to see and desire a woman first is rightly to claim possession of her. With this apology, the quarrel between the two men is over. Palamon is cheerless, lamenting, quote-unquote, "O cousin, that we should things desire which do cost us the loss of our desire, that naught could buy dear love but loss of dear love." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 109 through 112. This is to suggest that love is a zero-sum game, which is probably a better description of the outcome of this romance or tragicomic play than the usual term ascribed to such plays. Bittersweet connotes. Theseus's view of the outcome is that fortune has outdone herself. Quote unquote, "The conquered triumphs, the victor has the loss. Yet in the passage, the gods, have been most equal. Act 5, Scene 4, lines 113 through 115. Palamon saw Emilia first, so he, and not Arcite, will enjoy married life with her. Theseus, one of the greatest Greek heroes, says what he had better say. The gods, not he, are in control of all things, and he will not question their dispensation. He refers to adults as, in some sense, quote-unquote, children throughout their lives, and ends with, quote-unquote, let us be thankful for that which is, and with you leave dispute that are above our question. Act 5, Scene 4, lines 134 through 136. Well, that's the Duke's perspective, and it makes sense. But how, to consider the matter further, should we construe this ending, indebted as it is to the proximate source of the tale, Geoffrey Chaucer's The Knight's Tale, from the Canterbury Tales? As we have noticed, Theseus, for his notion of the gods' concern for equity, leans heavily on Palamon's justification of his sacred right to Emilia's affection, the prior temporal status of his sighting of Emilia. It is Palamon's deep and abiding, but also adolescent, conviction that he owns Emilia's heart simply because he saw her first. If we are the kind of audience that demands evidence of a fairly impressive providence at work in a romance play's successful ending, it's difficult to ascribe that status to a principle of ocular imperialism that the play itself has mocked, milking it for its comic value when it was first articulated by Palamon in Act 2, Scene 2. In truth, the idea seems like no more than standard patriarchal objectification, which isn't a very bright star to hitch our wagon to. There is also a sense throughout the play that, insofar as Emilia has a favorite, it's Palamon. Perhaps that's a providential hint. Still, it's also impossible to miss the lady's strong ambivalence about that choice. She really can't decide, and that is probably true for a more complex reason than that she means no harm to either man. Perhaps what we needed for a more satisfactory ending is any indication, as we do find at the very end of Chaucer's Knight's Tale, that Emilia herself is satisfied with what has happened. Pray yet stay a while, and let me look upon ye. The epilogue speaker says goodbye to the audience and expresses the wish that they have enjoyed the play. The epilogue speaker says nothing extraordinary, but is playful with the audience, almost seeming at first to provoke hisses and insults from them. He says, quote-unquote, pray yet stay a while, and let me look upon ye, so that he may contemplate them as a group and individually. Epilogue lines 3 through 4. Then, however, the speaker reminds the audience that they have too abiding a connection for any unpleasant expressions of dislike to be appropriate. If the play has been pleasing, well, that was the quote-unquote end, and in any case, says the speaker, quote-unquote, ye shall have, ere long, I dare say, many a better to prolong your old loves to us. Epilogue lines 15 through 17. That's poignant, since the two noble kinsmen, dating to 1613 or 1614, is widely considered to have been Shakespeare's last play, though not John Fletcher's last effort, since he lived until 1625. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Tuesday, December 9th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.